take up the radical reformation. One can call the designation radical into question, suggesting that these people are anything but radical. But this is the term that by which they are normally designated. I think that therefore we can validly use it. Sometimes these people are called the Anabaptists. This term is just as difficult because some of these individuals and groups did not practice rebaptism or baptizing again. If you are interested in doing some reading on this subject, the most recent work on the radical reformation has been done by Williams of the Divinity School of Harvard University, entitled The Radical Reformation. It's a lengthy, masterful, detailed study of these individuals. You will be spending much time with them in the next course, Church History 3, because the radical reformers are those who contribute very much to modern social and political structures. Now, actually, this presentation today should follow the material of Luther after 1521. And this is as far as you were supposed to have gotten last Wednesday. You will be getting there by next Wednesday, a week from this coming Wednesday. But since Mr. Bertram is at Worcester these days, he is not able to be here to complete this, so we're going to interject this material here, and then next week he will continue with the presentation of Luther. Let me give you merely some of the dates in connection with Luther so that the material I give you today will fit in properly, at least in your mind. The two dates that you were given last week of rather crucial importance are 1505, the date when Luther received his M.A., and the date when he entered the monastery. It's a kind of date on which you can hang a lot of clothes. Those are the days when, that's the date when Luther entered the university. If you compare this day with the date that other reformers entered the university, you get, graduated from the university, you get some idea of where they are chronologically over against each other. The second date is 1512, the date when he received his doctorate, his earned D.D., and the date when he began to teach. Now, the dates that follow are necessary, it seems to me, to see where we are in connection with Luther as we discuss the radical. In 1517, he posted the theses. In this action, the Reformation, the Lutheran Reformation specifically, Luther's activity takes a new direction. Up until that point, he had been primarily interested in what we would call, I suppose, biblical scholarship. He had been concerned to spell out as well as possible the core and the implications of God's attitude toward man, and no more than that. With the 95 Theses, he becomes a part of the political and social and economic movement in Germany, indeed in Europe as a whole. I think we can put this most simply by saying that up until 1517, and indeed even after, the great theological debates
Many of them take place after 1517 and 1518 and 19, where Luther is still primarily concerned with questions in connection with justifying righteousness and things of that sort. So we can say, in the first place, he is concerned with grace, if you will, a generalization, whereas with 1517, Luther must become more and more concerned with church when he comes into conflict, obviously, with ecclesiastical authority. The two dates of crucial importance here are 1519, where he debates with Eck. By this time, he has already come to the conclusion, especially in preparing for this debate, that there was something lacking in the Roman view of the nature of the church. And by 1521, when he is excommunicated from the Roman church, the Decet Romanum, in January, and then in April, when he is cited before the Diet at Worms, these two dates then, 1519 and 1521, are of crucial importance. Now, what we want to say today takes place, by and large, after this date, 1521. After Luther is excommunicated, and after he has appeared before Worms and refuses to recant, he goes into hiding. He is led into this via those who were protecting him, but in any event, he goes into hiding for a number of years, there continuing to write, continuing to circulate tracts, translating, things of that sort, but he is not on the scene, so to speak, at Wittenberg. Now, it's at this point in the Reformation, then, while Luther is at the Wartburg, and before you have the Augsburg Confession, for example, in 1530, and these 8 or 9 years in between, that the great conflict, the debate takes place as to what is truly the Reformation of the Church. Is Luther really a reformer, or is he a betrayer of Reformation within the Church? Because true Reformation must go much further than Luther was willing to take it. It must go as far as the radical reformers wanted to take it. Very important. I think a great case can be made, and it has often been done, to show that Luther was essentially a conservative. And Luther had no intention of reforming anything. To begin with, he says later on himself that he was led into all of this, like a horse with blinders on his eyes, simply directed where to go from outside of himself. This is, of course, rather subjective with Luther, but as we review it, it seems to be the case. Once Luther gets beyond this basic insight of the nature of grace, he is no longer really a reformer. Especially in the areas of social and economic and political thought. Here Luther is very, very much a conservative, as we will see now in taking up the more radical reformers, both in Wittenberg and elsewhere. Now, first of all, then, the orientation of these radical reformers. It's rather necessary to begin in this way, because there is no Luther among the radical reformers. You don't have a radical church established, so to speak, as you have a Lutheran church established. Rather, you have a number of individuals, all of whom were, I suppose we would say today, individualists, who are simply classified by us today as the radicals in the Reformation period. Many of them did not know each other. They were from different parts of Europe, but they have certain things in common. And this is why we speak of them today as the radical reformers. Sometimes, I think, unfortunately, we read these individuals off as the nuts of the Reformation period and don't take them seriously. This is unfortunate because one cannot understand the history of modern Protestantism, much less the history of modern Lutheranism, unless one begins to understand the concerns of the Radical Reformation. They have had a profound influence on modern Protestantism, to say the very least. Indeed, a great deal that has been written about Luther in Protestant Christianity is written from the presupposition of Protestantism in general, and from positions first enunciated via the Radical Reformation. Aside from this man Williams, one of the most important scholars in this area is Roland Bainton, who just retired, as you know, from Yale University. His book on the Radical Reformation, his book on the Reformation in the 16th century, his book on the Travel of Religious Liberty, which you will be reading next quarter, all of these books deal more or less with this radical thrust out of which he himself comes, of course, being a Quaker. Now, because these individuals were just that, individuals, they were often persecuted, and when an individual is persecuted, he tends sometimes to go to extremes, and you do have individuals in this grouping who do that, and therefore they are characterized sometimes as the unimportant ones, because they are not, you take them as seriously as you take other things that are irrational. But there are certain things that they do hold in common, and I have tried to point them out in the next items on this page in order to show you the kind of direction that all of these individuals took and what they have in common. And the first thing is that they were anti-ecclesiastical, very much like the Cathari, the heretics that we have already discussed in the medieval period. There is a connection between the Anabaptists of the Reformation and the heretics of the Middle Ages. By the way, a new book has just appeared on these radicals of the Middle Ages by Tuberville, T-U-R-B-E-R-V-I-L-L-E. It is not in the library yet, but it will be. I have not looked at it. I just have seen the publicity on it. Heresy and the Inquisition in the Middle Ages. But there you find much that is common to the Anabaptist movement in the Reformation. Anti-clericalism, anti-ecclesiastical. Finding a basic sympathy with Luther's antagonism to a man like Tetzel. That kind of clericalism. They felt they had a champion in Luther. When Luther would write about the ministry the way he does in his early writings, talking about the priesthood of all believers, as distinct from sacerdotalism. You see, they thought they had an ally here. But Luther doesn't go to the limits or to the extent that these individuals go. Indeed, the Lutherans retain the ministry, as they indicate in the Augsburg Confession. when these radicals claim Luther as their champion, the opponents of Reformation in Europe, the Roman Catholics, tend to put Lutherans and radicals, Zwinglians, all into one group, you see. And so it is necessary in 1530, when the Lutherans write their confession of what they believe and teach, to show not only how they differ from Roman Catholicism, but also to show how they differ from these radicals
in their Catholicity.
It's very important that you see this, because the two were confused. The radical reformers claimed Luther
as one of their mentors, and when he was not willing to go along with them
after 1521, they looked upon him as a betrayer.
The fact that they were as anti-clerical as they were naturally led to persecution.
They did not have the civil backing that Luther had in Saxony,
which is, humanly speaking, what preserved him from martyrdom, persecution and martyrdom. They did not have this, these radical reformers, and consequently many of them were martyrs. If you look at the authors of and the composers in a Baptist hymn book, as Bainton points out, they read drowned 1525, burned 1526,
beheaded 1527, hanged 1528, and so on. Almost all of these individuals to whom the Anabaptists, who were the radicals, so to speak,
all met this kind of
martyrdom, as they spoke of it. This leads them to the next thing.
Religious liberty.
They believe that they should have the right to believe and teach as they please, regardless of what
a prince
believes, regardless of what the Roman Church might teach. And consequently, these radical reformers are, to a very great degree, the founders of what we pride in today as religious liberty, or, if you will, separation of church and state. Luther was not willing to go this far. Luther does not go this far. The theological foundations are in places laid for this position in Luther, but he does not go along here. As you know, when Luther establishes churches, when changes are made, he always does this
in connection with the Elector of Saxony.
We'll see this in connection with his conflict with Karlstadt.
When they attempt
to reform the church in all of Saxony by visiting the various churches, the visitations were, the personnel of the visitations was always had a representative of the civil authority on it, the consistory of the Lutherans, that is the governing body of these Lutheran churches
in Germany, always had representatives of the civil authority.
There is no separation here. Even though Luther does talk about congregationalism and things of this sort, especially in his writings before 1521. This is, of course, rather important to note.
So these individuals are the ones that stood for religious liberty.
Primarily because they were being persecuted
and beheaded by those who didn't believe in it and were not willing to allow them to express their Christian faith, as they call it, as they please. This leads to number four, then, their refusal to cooperate or participate in the functions
Of the state. You find this also taken up in the Augsburg Confession.
The Anabaptists were those who opposed oaths in court,
who opposed Christians taking public office, because this, they would be required to do things that a Christian cannot do. They were not allowed to participate in carnal warfare, as the Augustana puts it. And that is, they were allowed and encouraged to war against the evil spirits, but they were not,
in fact, they were forbidden to fight for an earthly prince. And they opposed capital punishment, needless to say. Now, all of these things have a theology for them, but that they should come into existence precisely among these people is also
can also be explained, shall we say, sociologically,
by their because of the fact that they were hounded, as they were, all over Europe, as a result of their religious individualism. Secondly, these individuals are known for their efforts at restoring primitive perfection. Primitivism and perfectionism, as we sometimes call it today. All of this, of course, Luther characterizes as Schwärmerei. Buzzing flies who do nothing else, do nothing other than confuse the issue. For these individuals, the church was made up of only true believers. This in opposition to the territorial church. In other words, they stood for the church as made up of individuals who choose to join it, not as it was in Europe and has been generally since, where you choose not to be a member of the church. You see, this is still true today, for example, in Germany, where you have separation of church and state today. If you don't want to pay the ecclesiastical tax, you are perfectly free not to pay it, but you have to say you are not a member. You disclaim any membership or any of the fruits, the rights and privileges of church membership. These radical reformers said that this is not what the church is. The church is called out from society. It is not, you don't simply assume that all of the individuals in a given geographical area, a given parish, all belong to the church simply because they live there. Some of you have studied Kierkegaard, I'm sure, Kierkegaard, and of course you know that he says the same thing at a later date. Because really, the Reformation, the radical reformers don't win here. It is the Lutheran tradition of the territorial church that prevails in Germany and in France. Well, you don't even have that in France, but especially in Switzerland and in Germany, rather than this idea of religious liberty, where every individual's conscience is the sovereign arbiter of what he shall choose for himself. In any case, they taught that in the early period, people chose to belong to the church, and these people who chose this were then the true believers, you see. Then these individuals were all priests. Here you have the anti-clerical accent coming through again among these Anabaptists or these radicals, the universal priesthood of all believers. That Luther accents alongside of a ministry, a special ministry, an ordained ministry. They didn't make the distinction. Every man is a priest. And anything beyond that is a human creation. The ministry is established as a function, but not as a form that is separate from the very beginning, from the priesthood of all believers. The special priesthood comes out of the priesthood rather than being parallel to it. Then they were, and these priests in this universal priesthood were the true believers. Now we'll talk about that when we get to some of these individuals. But you always have to remember that. It's not just anyone, but it's the true believer. There's a great stress on that. And especially then on discipline in these small groups. They were known for their high morality. This is where they accused Luther of being a failure. And this criticism touched Luther. He felt this. Because Luther begins prior to 1521 with many of the same principles. That if you preach the gospel, and if people really believe the gospel, if they hear it, the Spirit will work and they will believe. Then a changed kind of life will follow. The standards of morality will naturally comply with the standards of the gospel. This didn't happen. And we are told that one time Luther got so irritated with his congregation at Wittenberg that he threw the Bible down in the pulpit and stalked out and walked out of the city. And wasn't even going to come back to this congregation until his good wife Katie ran out after him and asked him, "Martin, where do you think you're going to go?" And his answer was, "Out under the stars." But he came back. You will often get this same kind of feeling as a parish pastor. You have the same kind of confidence in the gospel, and then somehow this confidence is somehow compromised. And when this happens, I think you have to do what all of us have had to do in the past, and that's look at your own life, and then you begin to understand a few things. In any case, the basic point here is that these individuals, these radicals, expected Luther to champion the kind of new legalism, as we call it, that they stood for, that if an individual wants to be a member of the church, the level of his life has got to show this. It's the function of the church to make sure that it does. And they didn't call this legalism. They called it merely the result of preaching the gospel, as Luther called it in his early writings. But they forced it. Then it becomes legalism. In any case, these groups were known for their high morality. They are not known for promiscuity or for being ecclesioli, as we have learned to call them from the period of Pietism, but actually these were small circles of Christians where the ethical level was higher because they stressed it. And Luther then is accused of being the betrayer, quite obviously, because Wittenberg did not evidence this higher ethical level. Thirdly, these individuals stood for adult baptism. There are two terms here, I suppose, that you have to know if you don't already. Anti-pedobaptist, that is, that they oppose the baptism of infants, and consequently they baptize again, Anabaptism, those who had been baptized
as it were, against their will, as infants. One of the marks of these individuals, this is not limited to the radicals, but they have very little emphasis on externals and consequently little emphasis on either liturgy, church buildings, sacraments, things of this sort. There's very little emphasis on these things. Their whole concern was with the inner moral life, moral and spiritual life of the individual, and this obviously would lead to an emphasis on adult baptism as well as on communion as being nothing more than an external practice which evidences fellowship. One of these radicals by the name of Hookmeyer was accused of baptizing people in a milk pail, from a milk pail, simply to show that the externals here, even in the baptism of adults, are not as meaningful as what takes place within the individual. Now, it's this core of ideas that spreads out in many directions among these radicals. There are many ways that you can classify this. I have chosen this way. If you read other books, you will find the classifications done otherwise. But I think that these three things, anti-clericalism, primitive perfectionism, and adult commitment or adult baptism, characterize most, at least, of these radicals or the so-called Anabaptists. But from this core, then, this movement takes many forms. And I have, then, three examples of the forms that this takes, or the direction into which this goes. The first one is Conrad Grebel, G-R-E-B-E-L, an individual who worked in Zurich, Switzerland, the same city that Zwingli will reform, as we will see tomorrow. He was an associate in the Reformation of Zwingli. Later, he becomes his antagonist. A great debate takes place between the two in 1525, after which Grebel is exiled. The principles of Grebel and the Swiss reformers, as they are called, of which Zwingli is a more conservative part, are summarized in the famous Schleitheim article of 1527. That you can read, in Grimm, I believe, at least they're summarized in Grimm. They are also in Williams, and I just saw them printed the other day in a new book of documents from Christian history, published by I'll think of it. Anyway, the Schleitheim articles, they're rather important because they summarize the position of these radicals. Essentially, Grebel went along with Zwingli, except on this issue of the believer's church. Zwingli still held to the idea of the territorial church. Either none of Zurich is reformed, or all of Zurich is reformed. In other words, Zurich as a city becomes Protestant, leaves the Roman fold. Whereas Conrad Grebel believed that this should be left to the individual to decide. As far as Zwingli was concerned, and here Luther and Calvin would agree with him, this could lead only to anarchy. Religious anarchy, and they wanted none of that, and as well as persecution, of course. Let me just give you a couple of the things that are, by the way, these are also in Church History from June 1955. Maybe that's an easier way of reading them. Church History, June 1955, the Schleitheim article. Zwingli was a believer in the Volkskirche. The church is is society seen religiously.
You see.
And everyone in Zurich is supposedly, and the government of Zurich especially, is parallel and integrated with the government of the church in Zurich. They're medieval. It's something you're born into. Or the whole city, not an individual, but the whole group, chooses to become. And against this, Grebel taught that the church was a society of believers and something that you chose to form or join. And then he goes down the line with all of these things that I've said. The priesthood, as it were, or the ministry comes out of this group, not necessary to have one individual in the group who is such a minister. It can be shared by a number from within the group as the Spirit moves. So what we could call, I suppose, a charismatic ministry. And the same kind of de-emphasis on the sacrament. But the most important thing about Grebel, as far as I can see, for our purposes here, is to see how he gets into trouble, actually, with Zwingli, who was a more radical reformer, we suggest, than Martin Luther, but not as radical as those whom we classify as the radical reformers. Now, the next individual is Andrew Buddenstein von Carlstadt, who died in 1541, who was first an associate and then an antagonist of Luther, especially in the years following Luther's return from the Wartburg, 1521 and 22. While Luther was at the Wartburg, 1521 and 22, and then after that. And then Luther's famous Wittenberg sermons, the eight Wittenberg sermons that were preached against the efforts of Carlstadt, where he attempts to spell out how you interpret Scripture, the ethical implications of Scripture, and he talks about the spirit and the letter of Scripture, and then especially the conflict or the distinction between the weak and the strong Christian. Now, Carlstadt is a very interesting example of this radical Reformation. Carlstadt was a learned man. He was the dean of the University of Wittenberg, the dean of the faculty, when Luther received his doctorate in 1512. Although Carlstadt was a follower of the Via Antiqua, that is, he was a Thomist, in order to refute many of the things that Luther was teaching in the years after 1512, he studied Augustine as Luther had studied him, and this led him into the camp of Luther. In fact, Carlstadt wrote 380 theses to defend Luther's 95. And this sort of characterizes this fellow, the brilliant man, not perhaps as dynamic, as keen as was Luther himself, but still a very intelligent individual. During the Diet of Worms and the period just prior to Luther's captivity at the Wartburg, Carlstadt was sent to Denmark, for example, to lead the Reformation there. He was unsuccessful, simply because he didn't have this ability of Luther to hold back, if you will, or to work with the powers that be. He always had to go to extremes. Actually, the debate with Eck in 1519 was originally to be a debate with Carlstadt. But ultimately, after he and Carlstadt finished the debate, and the important part of the debate takes place between Eck and Luther. There is a point in the career of these two men where Carlstadt and Luther are actually working together. And this is the period of the great debate at Leipzig between Luther and Eck. But after that, and this is especially during the period when Luther is at the Wartburg that their paths part, because it's during this period that Carlstadt takes over the leadership of the Reformation movement in Saxony. Luther wanted Melanchthon to do it,
or Justice Jonas. But neither Justice Jonas was the pastor, as it were, at the church in Wittenberg. But Jonas is not willing to do this, nor is Melanchthon, so the lot falls to Karlstadt. When he becomes the leader, he carries through all of these radical innovations, most of which he could quote Luther's support for which he could quote Luther's support. But Luther always talks about this as the way perhaps it ought to be done, and in that sense, the way it may be done. You don't have to, for example, Holy Communion can be celebrated by an individual who is dressed in overalls. For Karlstadt, the May seems to quickly turn into a must. It's very difficult to express, but this was a way of purifying the church, of getting back to this primitive purity. This is the way it was done in the early church, according to Karlstadt. This is the way it ought to be done. It must be done in 16th century Wittenberg. So that Karlstadt celebrates Holy Communion. As Luther had often indicated, by allowing the individual to receive the Eucharist under both forms, and by allowing them to take the wafer and to touch the cup, you see, to actually drink it themselves, and not having it poured into their mouth by the individual who is celebrating. All of these things Luther, Karlstadt, puts into operation precisely the way Luther described them. Only he does it without getting permission from the elector, and certainly he does it, when he does it, he causes a great deal of confusion in Wittenberg. This is not altogether the fault of Karlstadt, because he was associated with a number of other individuals, leaders of these radical movements in various parts of Europe, Gabriel Zwilling, for example, and Mark Stiebner and Nicholas Storch, all of whom we would have to classify with the Anabaptists. But once this takes over, that you've got to purify the church and take it back to that church, the primitive church, the first century church, this goes to extremes, as you well know. Luther then has to return from the Wartburg to rectify things. He preaches his 8th sermon on not going too fast, having regard for the consciences of the weak in anything that you do. And Karlstadt is exiled. That's what always happens, you see, to the radicals. Exiled for disorderly procedure. He ultimately goes to Orlemünde, where Luther is actually the one who encourages the villagers there to hire Karlstadt to lead them in worship. But there he preaches often against the Reformation as it was going in Wittenberg. There's a lengthy debate at one point between Luther and Karlstadt in Orlemünde, and Luther leaves the village with the people throwing stones after him. They have been so taken up with the reform movement of this individual Karlstadt. He would not wear any ecclesiastical garments. He insisted that they refer to him as Brother Andrew or Neighbor Andrew. Even his students referred to him in that way.
In fact, he didn't believe that, that there was any place in the church for a distinction between professor and student. They are all comrades, and they should address each other in that way. Colleagues, and this, of course, all comes out of his emphasis on the priesthood of all believers, even in things like this. He would go into the classroom and teach and learn, I suppose, at the same time, dressed as Brother Andrew, coming out of his potato patch, where he spent the rest of his time. A very interesting individual, one that would merit some study on your part. His writings are also rather fascinating reading, especially as you see them in contradistinction to Luther. Certainly you want to read Luther's 8 Wittenberg sermons with the Karlstadt background in mind. So another individual who is very important in this connection is Thomas Münzer. You can spell that with or without the T. He was the preacher at Zwickau, and he too must be numbered among these radical reformers. He believed that the church was made up of the covenant people who were elected in the first place, but this election is obvious via their ethical life. But Münzer differed from the others in that he believed that this elect group, this elect circle, should form such a circle in the midst of a geographical area, something like the Saxon fathers did when they went down to Perry County, to found an eschatological society where you leave the world, as it were, while you're here, to live in your own circle. Apart from society, you don't settle in St. Louis to sinful, but you settle apart from the world, apart from from the heathen, to find your own society. This is what Münzer does then in places like Mühlhausen and Funkenhausen. And Luther, of course, writes his very famous tract, and this too ought to be read in connection with an understanding of men like Münzer and Karlstadt, Against the Heavenly Prophet. Book 2, or the second section of this Against the Heavenly Prophet, is clearly directed against Karlstadt, and the rest, of course, is directed against Münzer. It's very fascinating. But Münzer carries this idea of a pure society to the extreme of setting up this eschatological society in these two cities, Mühlhausen and Frankenhausen. He drills the peasants to defend this holy place, this holy community. The difficulty was that the peasant army would not join up with the garrison, the trained soldiers, because they were not part of the religious community to fight. And so they were both defeated independently in 1525, and Münzer is martyred, as they said. Here again, this battle of Mühlhausen is part of the so-called peasant revolt in Germany that Luther is supposed to have encouraged via his treatise against the thievish murderous hordes of peasants. I think that this takes a great deal more study than we have time to give to it here, but perhaps you will take the course on Luther next year, where more time will be given to this. Now, in all of these things, I think the last comment is extremely important, and that is that it's not always possible, as it is for us today, looking back on this, and because perhaps our emotions are less involved in all of these things, it's much easier for us to distinguish
between the reformers of the Lutheran stripe and the reformers of the kind that you have in Karlstadt or a Münster, especially when we recognize that Luther was the individual who often made it possible for these men to retain parishes in Saxony, even though he did not agree with them at this point. And consequently, in 1530, when Eck writes his theses against the Augsburg Confession, he interprets much of what the Lutherans say there in terms of these Anabaptists, and consequently Melanchthon is forced to write an apology in which he spells out quite clearly just how the Augustana is directed against these radical reformers as much as the abuses in the Roman Church, and that therefore Lutherans cannot be classified with either.
Okay.